It's estimated that between 12 and 30 million people in the United States have some form of sex addiction. And pardon the pun, but it goes hand in hand with pornography addiction. Today, we talk with a marriage and family therapist as we learn more about sex and pornography addiction. Thanks for listening to Learning More. It's Russ with you. Yes, we are talking about sex and pornography addiction. I feel like by putting that in the title and then making the silly pun right there in the start, I feel a little like Lo Geraldo, you know, from the 80s, right? I am not doing that kind of show today. No, we are taking the high road here, and we are talking with a licensed marriage, family, and therapist. He hosts a podcast. He's written books. He hosts courses on recovery from sex and pornography addiction, and he's just an all-around great guy. His name is Tony Overbay. Tony, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity to come on your show. I really like your I like your energy. I like your vibe. I've been looking forward to this. So wherever we go today, I'm ready.
All right. Well, let's start at the beginning here, because here's the big question that I have. Is sex addiction and porn addiction the same thing?
That is a great question. And watch me then go completely in a different direction. But I promise you, I hear your question, right? And that is one of the interesting things is there really isn't. And if you look at our diagnostic and statistical manual that therapists, clinicians that we deal with, there really isn't a diagnosis of either one, of sex addiction or porn addiction. So you can look at things like impulse control disorder or compulsive sexual behavior. But I think in reality, what we're talking about is, are there healthy ways to express oneself sexually? Is pornography, is it ever a good thing for an individual or a couple? Or I feel like those are the things that come into my office often. So I guess that's a long way to answer your question and say, since they aren't necessarily a clinically diagnosed thing, then I would say that they aren't really similar. But if you look at the concepts of why people turn to porn or sex as a coping mechanism, then I think they have a whole lot of similarities. So there, now we've landed the plane back again, right?
Okay, yeah. Perfect. Okay, but so is it generally just a coping mechanism?
So that's what I find. And this is what's interesting is if you look at the concept of healthy sexuality, you are really looking at people have completely different experiences of what that means. So if you go back to, and we'll go back to people's origin stories, if people talked about sex pretty openly in their home growing up, then they're going to have a completely different relationship with sex or sexuality. Or if sex was shamed, if sex was, you know, something that people never talked about growing up, then they're even going into relationships where a lot of the clients I work with grew up feeling like they couldn't talk about anything sexual with their parents. But then they were given this message of, but when you're married, then, hey, go for it, champ. You know, it'll be great. And so people would then think that, all right, no, we told him that he can, when he's married, then everything's going to be great. He can have all the sex he wants, but not realizing that we've launched people into relationships having a pretty unhealthy view of sexuality. And so then they get to marriage or in a committed relationship, and all of a sudden that isn't just this miracle fix to just all of a sudden be in a relationship. And now you've got two people that have completely different relationships or expectations sexually that are coming together. So so I really feel like the place that we really need to begin is just looking at what is someone's relationship with sex. Was it something that they talked about in the home? And when they did talk about it, was it talked in a way of shame? Was it a shame-based model? Was it a strength-based model? Was it a, hey, you can ask me any question? Or was it a, we don't talk about that in our home? And I do a lot of work around parenting as well. And I throw out this thing that I think we run into so often where a parent will say, hey, you can come and talk to me about anything. And I know as I've got four kids myself, I mean, I've given that speech many times. But then if the kid comes and says, hey, a cop pulled us over or came over and I was in a car and, caught me having sex with my girlfriend, instead of the parent saying, hey, thanks for coming to talk to me about that. You know, this is a what? You know, you were doing what? And so then, you know, when we're sending that message of, no, you can talk to me about anything except for those things, you know, sex, drugs, right? Yeah, exactly. Which then sets
shame you for it.
Totally. And then I'll tell you another thing I think is fascinating too, Russ, is I thought, even though I didn't grow up getting the talk by my parents, I assumed that everybody else did. But then, boy, when I talk with people in my office, I think it's very rare that people have the talk about sex with their kids, or they may have one talk about it when the kid's 10, 11, 12, and then check the box, say we talked about it, and then that's it. So I just think we just don't talk about healthy sexuality much at all, which then can lead to people turning to different of these vices as coping mechanisms.
You know, okay, so I'm a big old TV fan.
Okay.
Right. And when you look at like 80s TV shows, you hear them say that, oh, the talk or this or that. There were all these things kind of around sex. And it felt like Household sort of mirrored that, right? Yeah. The sitcom life of like, oh, well, sex is out there, but we're not going to talk about it. And I feel like that was a lot of homes.
Absolutely.
Like, for a long time. And I guess that's because what we learned either from television or from, you know, whatever else we were seeing.
Yeah.
And I guess now you're seeing the impact of that.
That's a great way to put it. Actually, it absolutely is. And I'm a big fan of old TV as well. And you've got parents sleeping in different beds even.
Right.
And then, you know, and if somebody did bring up, there was a lot of innuendo and some laughter and then the feeling of, okay, we talked about it. Or there was the, you know, the talk about the birds and the bees. We would talk about that.
Right.
But in reality, a healthy way to talk about this is to start talking about, and it sounds kind of funny then, because I think exactly what you're talking about, where we didn't see this modeled, but you're using the right words. You're starting to talk about it sooner than later. You're making it something that is, there's just no negative energy around it. And this is where I'll talk to parents and I'll say, man, the one thing you can start doing when your kids are little is start doing some sort of daily mindfulness practice or something of learning how to put a little pause between your reaction and when your kids tell you something, because that is a critical moment is when your kid does come. It is, right? Because when your kid comes and says they did anything, I wrecked the car, I got home late, I got in a fight, I got a bad grade. If we can just take one beat and pause and just realize, man, I'm so grateful that they came to talk to me about this. That is one of the biggest parenting tips I think I can, known to man, is to be able to say, hey, I really appreciate you letting me know about that. Even if on the inside we're screaming like, are you kidding me? This is gonna be a nightmare to deal with, but just being so grateful for that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, you know, and I think, I think it can be really difficult for some people to kind of start that conversation.
Yeah.
Right. Like the beginning of it, I would assume, you know, for many people would be very difficult. But as with anything, if you have that conversation with your kids over and over again, it does get easier.
It does. It so does.
Now, what do you recommend for parents for that first conversation? Are we talking making PowerPoints? like, how do we have the talk?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a great. I have not yet put together a nice PowerPoint for the parents and the kids. But I do say though that I've been doing this long enough that I remember back when I would go out and speak to groups and say, if your kid sees porn. And then now the shift was a decade ago where it's when your kid sees porn. And I think right alone, just having that of a mindset shift for a parent is knowing that your kids are seeing it and they're seeing it all around them. And so instead of then saying, you're not seeing porn, are you? But we would get together weekly with my family and just kind of chat, try to play a game, you know, get some brownies, the scent of a brownie is going in the air because that makes everything better. And then I would often say things like, hey, all right, so you guys, and I know, Russ, I know it's easy because I am literally a therapist, so I know that I get to say it easy, but it's, when's the latest, or when did you see porn last? Like, how's it creeping into your guys' lives? Is it coming through Instagram? Is it coming through Snapchat? You know, are people really sending nudes to people, or what's that like? And I feel like when you approach it with curiosity, and that's a key word, when you approach it with curiosity, and then know still that your kid still is going to think, oh, well, I'm not answering this. Like, what's their angle? You know, right. As soon as I say, yeah, we see it on Snapchat, then they're like, well, then give me your phone. You know, I mean, so, but I think they're just starting to have the conversation. And because I think that was where it was easy for me to say, hey, I'm talking to people in my office and they're sharing these different things with me. But there's enough information out there that I feel like as a parent, if we read something that says any news story that talks about people sending nudes in schools, or people getting, some teacher does something and gets caught in some high school, of just being able to approach your kid with curiosity of, hey, have you guys ever heard about this kind of stuff? Or does this happen in your school? Or I remember talking with one of my daughters and her boyfriends just about vaping, you know, and inside I'm hoping, please don't say that you've ever vaped. Please don't say that you've ever vaped, right? But then saying, hey, okay, so all I'm hearing about is kids vaping. And, you know, the joke in one of the high schools here locally is that the bathroom is the vape room. So people will say, hey, why are you, you know, trying to use the bathroom here in the vape room, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so as much as I think, oh my gosh, I hope that isn't happening. I hope that isn't what my kids are experiencing, but being able to go in with curiosity and questions to your kids and say, hey, tell me more about this. And just know that instead of, I often say that we go in as parents and we start to lecture and then we ask questions. And man, we have to flip that thing around. We have to ask questions and then, quite frankly, still put off the lecture. Because we'll say, well, you know, I was reading about pornography and I sure hope you guys aren't, you don't have this on your phone. I hope you've never sent somebody a picture of your, you know, your whatever. But now that I've made you feel scared and bad about that, tell me, have you guys ever done that? I mean, you know, just look at that, the way we're doing that. Because what kid on earth is going to say anything about it? And I think that that's what then now we're kind of getting into this world of when we start to put this fear or shame around talking about pornography or about if a kid has looked at pornography, if they're struggling with pornography, that once we get that shame piece associated, now that kid's going to even feel bad about the fact that, oh my gosh, I can't talk to my parents about it. And I'm doing this. So is that a bad thing? I didn't realize it was a bad thing, or I didn't realize I'm doing something wrong. And so then they're just carrying this extra burden or this extra emotional baggage around with them, instead of then feeling like they can go to a parent and say, man, yeah, I have seen this a lot, you know, yeah, it is on my phone, or I've got myself in a situation where somebody's, I don't know, blackmailing me or threatening me with something that maybe we've talked about earlier, or we live in a little bit of a different world. And I'm not trying to say that as a doom and gloom world, but it's just different than you and I were growing up. Right, Russ?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, they're three clicks away.
Yeah.
From I think that's what they say, right? Yes. Every website's three links away from pornography. Absolutely. I mean, it's out there. It's everywhere on the internet, you know? And it's like I watched, what was that show? It was a movie where, you know, these kids from the 80s and, you know, like they're looking at women in bras in the JCPenney catalog.
Yeah. You
know what I mean? Like we didn't have that, you know, three clicks away.
No.
Then, you know,
I would have gone crazy. I mean, it's crazy to think what our kids are growing up with access to.
Well, and that's the thing. It's weird to put yourself in their position of like, what would I be?
Yeah.
If I were around that, what would I be doing? How would I take this? And I think that's always a nice way to flip it as well, is just kind of putting yourself in their seats of like, what if I had this when I was a kid? What would I have done?
Absolutely. Okay. I'm going to go on a tiny tangent, but I just kind of felt, oh my gosh, this fits in so well. A few years ago, I was a part of a consulting project and brought along with this organizational psychologist friend of mine. And we went to a very, very large corporation that employs, 10,000 or more employees a year. So young people coming out of college. And they had noticed that over the last few years, instead of the new employees sticking around for 3, 4, 5 years before they start looking at other opportunities, they were starting to leave in less than a year. So this company was trying to figure out how do we solve this problem. And they brought us in and they showed the most phenomenal data. And this is where I don't mention the company or because it was some proprietary data. And this is a company that I'm sure spent a tremendous amount of money getting this data. But they talked about how if you looked at back in the day, and I've been a therapist almost 20 years, but I did 10 years in computer software before that. And when I was when I was in that world, every couple of years, the size of a hard drive doubled and the microprocessor doubled in speed. And so they showed that nowadays that has happening every couple of months. And so there was this graph, and I'm showing you, but I know the listeners won't be able to necessarily get where I'm going with this. But if this is the line, you know, going straight up, and then there's this bell curve, it was barely just kind of off to the side when I was doing software 20, 25 years ago. Now, if we're looking at where we are as adults, this technology graph just goes completely off to the side, so that the technology is evolving every couple of months. And then they overlay this data that said that the generations are kind of following that similar pattern. And so where we kind of went with that was when I was talking with my dad about, he would be talking about records and I would be talking about CDs. So I still had an idea of what he was talking about. So we might get in a disagreement, but we really were still speaking the same language. So now if I'm talking about CDs, my kids are following this little, you know, technology graph and they're talking about instant access to every song and every video known to man and just exactly. binging. So, and I, the reason mm-hmm. I kind of go on this tangent is I feel like, so when we start to say, you know, when I was a kid, I had to look for it under the, my dad's nightstand to find the magazines that, so that was pornography. The kids don't care. I mean, they don't care at all. They don't want to hear those stories. And so they don't necessarily mm-hmm. relate to how we had to deal with things. And so I do feel like it's a whole different model of parenting where now we have to go in what kind of what we were just saying here, so much more curious. Right. And man, I can't even imagine what that would have been like for me. And instead of telling them, well, mm-hmm. here's what it was like for me. They've grown up with this device in their hand since the moment that they could started to interact with people. And that is the way that they communicate. So when we say, hey, well, just don't look at it. Don't click right. on it. I mean, the kid, that's where I think the kid just hears, I don't know what you're saying. You know, this doesn't right. even make sense to me. And so we really right. have to even parent in a different way now. And I feel like this yeah. is where, when I go back to yeah. this example with this company, we would, you know, they would still say things like, well, we shouldn't have to do that, you know? And then the people that had hired us to come in there said, okay, well then let's just continue to watch the people leave for other companies after 11 months. And that's what I feel like now. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, the kids shouldn't be looking on their phone. And it's like, okay, well, maybe they shouldn't, but they are like, they're going to. So we can't just say, don't look at it, you know, put your phone away or that sort of thing. Cause that's not the world that our kids have kind of lived in. So even if we are saying now we're going to put these really harsh restrictions and that sort of thing down, which even though as an old man that I am, as a professional that I am, that would be ideal. It would be fantastic if they didn't have access to this, this stuff on their devices. Taking away the device, only it doesn't make them say, oh my gosh, my mom and dad are right. I do need to go outside and ride my bike more and call my friends on the rotary phone. No, they say, mm-hmm. okay, I can't wait to get out from under my mom and dad's roof so that I can do whatever I want. So I feel like we need to look at this as this is an opportunity for us to be able to communicate more about curiosity and tell me what your experience is. And I realize right now, Russ, we aren't even talking about parenting and pornography. We're just talking about pornography. So I hope that wasn't too far off the beaten path, you know?
No. Well, you know, I mean, I think what we're, what you're saying there is really about, you know, preventative. We're talking about the ways early intervention, yeah. I guess, yeah. into this and what that does. I like this path. I want to continue down this path, but let's take a short break here.
Yeah.
And when we come back, we'll continue that conversation. If you enjoy history, maybe you're just feeling a little nostalgic, or you wonder who's having a birthday today, or maybe you need a reason to celebrate. Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It is called This Is Today. And each and every day, we talk about the historic events, celebrity birthdays. We also talk about whatever is going on today. There's always something to celebrate when you listen to This Is Today. And at just 10 minutes each day, you can make it a daily habit. You can even add it to your Alexa Flash briefing. Click the link in the description or just search in your favorite podcast app for This Is Today. And welcome back. Thank you for subscribing and listening to Learning More. I'm Russ. I'm talking with Tony Overbay. Today we are talking about pornography and sex addiction. We've sort of talked about the early stages, yeah, right? And yeah. early intervention into this, dealing with this as a parent. Yeah. Let me ask you this, because this is the question that I was thinking in my head as you were saying that. Does pornography have a place in a healthy sex life?
Okay, great question. All right. So kind of what we did in that first segment, I might go on a little bit of a tangent. So when I did change careers to be a therapist, I really wanted to help men. I just felt called to help men be better husbands and fathers. And so when I started working with clients, I didn't realize, number one, and I say this as a joke, but it's so real, men don't come to therapy. So then in the clinic that I was working, when I was kind of getting my hours initially, I would basically get men that were struggling with pornography. And at that point, we were calling it pornography addiction. So they would come in as part of, if they were struggling in their marriage. So if there were marriage difficulties, then it was almost like, okay, well, they're going to work with a marriage therapist. And then the guy is going to work with me for his porn addiction. That was the way it was put. So I'm starting to learn more about addictions. And there was a lot of behavioral interventions at that time. So when you want to look at porn, you know, do push-ups or go pet the family dog or go out for a walk or that sort of thing. And so I even was pretty gung-ho on that the first couple of years. Like, okay, you're doing your push-ups. And I have some guys who are getting pretty buff, but they're still turning to porn, you know? So that was a real challenge. So over the course of the next couple of years and working with men, I kind of on my I developed this theory that now I've run with for the last 10 to 15 years. I've got a book based off of it. My recovery program is based off of this. But I started to feel like it really is about these what I call voids at the time. And I felt like people were turning to pornography when they felt not connected in their parenting, which we kind of talked about earlier, in their marriage, in their faith, in their health, or in their career. And so what I started doing was I would say, okay, we'll talk a little bit about the behavioral piece, the pornography. What can you do? But then I started looking at, man, when we start helping people become better husbands, better fathers, getting the careers they like, get in touch with their health and their faith, that then the desire, the siren song of turning to porn was less. So, you know, and I felt like that was the part where I really started to see things help more, people get more distance between having the thought or the impulse and then acting out with pornography. So to go back to your question then, can a little bit of it be healthy? I started realizing that my job was not to say, this is what you need to do, because everyone, again, like we started, what we talked about at the beginning of this interview, mm-hmm. everybody has their own relationship with sexuality. And so if people really do feel like they don't even know what they're doing or thinking or talking about when it comes to sexuality, then there may be situations where they feel like that turning to pornography has been something that's been helpful. Now, I will, you know, I'm paid for my professional opinion. I believe that it doesn't have to have a place in a marriage, but I feel like the antidote to that is healthier communication. So if people mm-hmm. know how to communicate their sexual needs and desires, then they really, and I worked with well over 1,000 couples on this. I worked with over 1,500 people that have struggled with pornography as a coping mechanism over the years. So I feel very, very passionate about this. But I feel like it's a different way to look at this than me telling someone you should never look at porn. I want to meet somebody at this point where, okay, if you are looking at porn and you want to not look at it as much, if you want to grow closer to your spouse, then I've got tools that I can help. And I will say, and PS, I think that this is I think a lot of people don't even know what that would look like to not turn to porn as a coping mechanism or to not have pornography a part of their sexuality. But when they learn how to communicate better with their spouse, or when they learn how to mm-hmm. Kind of maybe sometimes even sit with that discomfort in their own lives and then turn toward more healthier coping mechanisms, where then they start to actually feel better about themselves. I call it raising their emotional baseline, that they start to just feel more in control mm-hmm. of their lives. And then that need to turn to porn for this quick pick-me-up lessons. And then the more they do that, the more they just feel more alive, more connected. And so with the couple, and I'll tell you this is something that that I love talking about, is as I started working with them with more couples, I would often find a guy coming in that's looking at me with his wife on the couch and saying, you know, I think I'm pretty simple. You know, if we're happy, why don't we celebrate with more sex? If we're sad, nothing picks me up like sex. If I'm sick, you know, I don't know, orgasm is far better than an aspirin, you know. And they're looking at me like, look, I made this easy. And they look at me like, you know, look at me like, can you just tell her so this will be easy? And I look over at the wife and I just get the same look. And I've said this like dozens of times, if not over 100 times, where then I look at the wife and I say, what do you hear there? And she'll say that I am the one that is in charge of all of his happiness. That if then for some reason that we're not having enough sex, then he's not as happy. He's not as good of a parent. He's not as excited about his job. And that's a big burden to carry. So, you know, then that one feels like he, in essence, is handing his responsibility for so many other things over to his wife, saying, hey, mm-hmm. You're in charge of the sexuality, and we need to make sure that you do this the way I want you to so that I will be happier. And I want you to know too, Russ, that like I'm using the proverbial male-female stereotype in this one, but I get situations where it is the opposite as well. Okay. But so then in that scenario, I often say, we got to change the whole relationship with sexuality. And there's some cool data that I use in my marriage therapy a lot, where it's normal for us to meet and then find somebody attractive. And then, but you know, if we look at that physical attraction, oftentimes that's, we've got the whole thing kind of backwards. So we find somebody attractive, but then we start to talk to them and the conversation doesn't go well, but we go, but you know, she's kind of hot, you know, and I'm being right. Or then we go to, or we start to communicate and then we start to get open up emotionally and that doesn't go well. But then we say, okay, but we are, I don't know, I enjoy physical intimacy with them, you know? And so I talk right. often about this thing called this intimacy pyramid, where our intimacy ladder, where in reality, we want to build our relationship off of verbal intimacy. We want to be able to communicate with our spouse about anything. And then once we feel more connected in that verbal intimacy, the next layer up this ladder is emotional intimacy. So when I feel like I can talk to my spouse about anything, then I can really start to open up to them. And above that is cognitive and intellectual intimacy. So this is when we often say one person can be a PhD and the other can have their GED. But if we're connected verbally and emotionally, then we still have this curiosity built within us. Above that is spiritual intimacy. You know, this is not per one particular view of spirituality, but you can see that if you're connected verbally, emotionally, cognitive, and intellectually, you can have two completely different spiritual paths and we still feel connected. And then physical intimacy, I feel, needs to be the byproduct of those. And but I feel like we often have it flipped. So it's the physical intimacy we often think needs to be the foundation. And then, you know, we work backwards from there, but then that's where you'll never, not never, too often people won't be on the same page physically. But if we can get dialed in that with that verbal and emotional intimacy, then, and I feel like when I talk about this, I feel like most anyone, a couple, can talk about times where they've just had this amazing day where they've been hanging out together. They've been talking about things. They've been opening up emotionally. They've been going out, doing things. And so by the end of the day, all they want to do is just be intimate, physically intimate, because this is my person. I mean, we just dig each other. And that is a fascinating and phenomenal view of intimacy. So the reason I even lay all this out is I say that we really need to change our relationship with intimacy in general. So I feel like when people do have pornography as a part of their relationship, that I feel like too often that's what they've kind of moved into that physical intimacy piece. So I feel like they're missing those lower levels of intimacy. And so again, this is where my goal is not to shame anyone and tell them they're doing it wrong, but I feel like there's a pretty cool way that might be even grow an even deeper connection.
Yeah, it's sort of, I guess, you know, it's taking a more difficult route because
absolutely, yeah, it is.
Communication is not always easy.
No,
right? I mean, it's not, and you know, listening, understanding, going through all, like, it's not always easy.
No,
in any relationship. And so the easy route is, oh, let's have sex.
Totally.
Or, oh, let's watch porn.
Yeah.
Or, so it's taking that easy path instead of the rocky road.
Yeah. Oh, you're very wise, my friend.
It might be unknown as well.
Yeah. So I think I talked when we were talking off air. I know. And again, I love this. You're very easy to talk to. I mean, we aren't even talking about this, but my opus is this marriage course that I do called the Magnetic Marriage Course, because it's exactly what you're talking about, where we struggle so much to just communicate, because we go into relationships as these, you know, we have our insecure attachments. We've got these needs to, we're trying to be our best selves to our spouse, but we've got this fear that if all of a sudden they know more about us, these deep things that are inside of us, that they'll run away. And so we're, you know, and this is what we do just by default, but we're kind of feeding our partners, our spouses, little bits of information. And then when we say, hey, what do you think about this? You know, what do you think about this movie? What do you think about this song? What do you think about this sex position? And if our spouses responds and they go, oh man, you don't like that, do you? You know, then all of a sudden we're like, oh no, I don't either. You know, oh no. But if we really do, we don't really have these good ways to communicate about these topics that we are coming at from completely different places. So I have the secrets to the universe for real. If you want to know these, Russ, do you want them?
No. Well, that would be great.
Okay, here we go.
That's a perfect perfect for the podcast.
I think so. So I'll go through this quickly. So I really have over the now. So working with well over 1,000 couples, not just on sexuality, but in communication, I've developed what I call my four pillars of a connected conversation. And the first one is that it's that no one wakes up in the morning and thinks, how am I going to hurt my spouse? You know, or so in reality, there's a reason why people do or say or act the way they do. So if your partner is withdrawn, or if they're angry or whatever that looks like, that means that, you know, I want a spouse to say, okay, there's a reason why that they feel this way, why they're coming at me this way, why they're withdrawn, why they're acting that way. So I want to know, I want them to tell me more. And so the second pillar I have is that you can't tell somebody that you think they're wrong or you don't believe them, even if you think they're wrong or you don't believe them. The third pillar is asking questions before making comments. And then the fourth pillar is you can't go into victim mode. So let me tell you what that looks like. So one of the easiest examples I give is, let's say that we'll go with the wife in this situation. If the wife says, hey, I feel like we don't have a deep sexual relationship. So, I mean, that is going to be hard for a guy to hear. And so, and I often say we're so afraid of contention that we avoid any tense conversation altogether. So if she's saying, I don't feel like we have a deep sexual connection, then if the guy can then say, all right, I'm going to assume good intentions. She's not trying to hurt me. There's a reason why she's expressing herself this, because that's going to allow him to stay present. The second part is if he feels like, well, I think our sex life is pretty good. You know, if he just says, well, I think you're wrong, or I don't believe you, the conversation's done. So that second pillar is he can't say, I don't believe you or I disagree, even if he doesn't believe her or he disagrees, which leads to the third pillar is to ask questions before making comments. So then he's saying, okay, I'm going to assume good intentions. I'm not going to tell her she's wrong. And then he's going to say, all right, hey, tell me more. Like, help me see my blind spots. What does that mean to you that we don't have this deep connection sexually? Mm-hmm. And so then as she expresses herself, this fourth pillar, guys are really bad at, truthfully, where it's don't go into victim mode. So if he can do the, all right, I'm going to assume good intentions. I'm not going to tell her she's wrong. I just ask questions. But then if he says, okay, fine. Well, I guess my opinion doesn't matter. And we will have sex whenever you want to, and we'll do it however you want to do it. You know, because then if he goes into this victim mode, then he's wanting her to say, no, I shouldn't have brought it up. You know, you're where everything's great. It's okay. And so in this model, once that she feels heard, now he gets to express himself as well. So then it's like, okay, I appreciate you sharing that. That would be hard if you feel like this is what our sex life looks like. And I appreciate you sharing that. And then if we can get him to stay in now the I feels, you know, I feel like we do have a good sex life, or I feel like the version that you're talking about is something that I would desire too. But when I try to have that deeper connection, you often seem tired, or you feel like you've been pawed over by the kids. Or so it's a way to get to these conversations where the goal is to be heard, not necessarily to resolve. And then, you know, right. and I stick people in this framework, the speaker, listener, and work on those four pillars, because we just don't communicate about sex. We don't communicate about parenting often. We don't communicate about our hopes and dreams, because sometimes when we do, those conversations devolve so quickly that then we just say, okay, you know what? We'll talk about it later. I mean, we'll talk about it when the kids get older. We'll talk about it when we have more money. We'll talk about it when we get further out of debt, and we're going to kick that can down the road forever, when in reality, those would be conversations to have right now.
And I know you just gave us some ways to start those conversations, but let's add some more things to the tool belt. So if somebody thinks they have either an addiction to pornography or sex in their relationship, if they're that person, what should they say to their spouse?
Man, okay, this is good, Russ. So, because it's funny, because I talk so much about do the marriage communication stuff, and I talk about pornography. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in a perfect world, you're adhering to these four pillars of a connected conversation, so that if a spouse, let's say the guy says, "Okay, I want a better relationship, and you know, and I keep turning to porn, and I don't feel good about it, and then I'm not showing up even my best self sexually." I mean, it's crazy to look at the highest rates of erectile dysfunction and sexual issues are now with it's like 18 to 25 year old males, or then 25 to 30. Wow. And it's because people are so used to turning to porn, because with porn, there's always a willing female. You know, there's always this dopamine rush, and the person isn't, you know, the willing partner is not sometimes sighing or saying, okay, well, we've got 5 minutes, or, you know, really tonight, or those kind of things. And so, so oftentimes the guy is feeling like, man, I wish we had a better sex life, but then I feel rejected, or I feel shut down because we don't interact well, we don't communicate well, which then just leads the guy to turn in back to porn. So I feel like this is one of those where, in a perfect world, man, to be able to throw things into the, hey, I want to share something with you, but it's scary for me. You know, I worry that you may not hear this the right way. I worry that you may think this is about you, but in actuality, I think you're amazing. And, you know, but I feel like when we aren't connected, then I find myself turning to porn as a coping mechanism. And that's why I kind of go back to, I don't talk about it as a sexual addiction, or even the pornography addiction, but more of turning to porn as a coping mechanism, because I feel like ideally most people want that intimate relationship, that physical intimacy, that verbal and emotional intimacy with their spouse. That's why we get married. That's why we couple. But then when we try to put ourselves in a position and we feel rejected or shut down, then our brain says, I know what we can do. You know, we can turn to porn. And so then we start turning to those things, those unhealthy coping mechanisms, more and more, because we don't even want to deal with the uncomfortableness of being rejected or things not going well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, and okay. So now I'm going to ask you for the other side of this. If you see your spouse doing this and you want to bring that up, what should you be saying? How should you be facing that?
That's a great question too. Even in these four pillars I talk about, I have what I call a one person version, where if I want somebody to tell me more, if I want to be able to express my needs, you know, I'm going to ask the person, hey, you know, I'm noticing that I've walked in on you looking at porn a couple of times. I've noticed that you maybe linger a little bit longer on certain women. I'm noticing that you maybe objectify them a little bit more. And as hard as that is as a conversation, it's like, tell me more about that. You know, tell me what's going on for you there. Because now the reason I bring up these four pillars is what I just did is I worked myself into this four pillared conversation where now I have to assume whatever he's going to say to me, he's not trying to hurt me. I can't tell him he's wrong, that second pillar. And I'm going to ask questions before I'm going to make comments. And I can't go into my, you know, if I'm the wife in this example, I can't now go into my bunker and say, okay, well, I guess you can just look at whatever you want to, and I'll just be here whenever you're ready. So I want him to be able to express himself and say, because maybe he isn't even aware that this is impacting his relationship. And so, but it's affecting her. And so being able to have the mm-hmm. conversation instead of making assumptions is going to be a great place to start. But so being able to say, hey, I'm noticing this, tell me more, or if it's even, I feel like we need help with this, or I feel like, you know, I would love to maybe not have that be as part of our relationship. So it goes back to, I appreciate you even heading down this direction. It's being able to have these uncomfortable conversations. And I feel like we don't really have good tools to do that because, I mean, number one, we weren't modeled these growing up. No one was. And then I often say as a marriage therapist, nobody has these tools until you have to go find the tools. And you don't go find mm-hmm. the tools until you're in a situation with your marriage where things don't seem like they're going great. And I wish we could give these tools to people earlier so they can communicate about things before they start to go south.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me to hear, you know, just talking with people. You know, I'm no therapist, but people come to me. Mm-hmm. I used to work for a radio station and I did like the Love Songs After Dark
show.
Where people would call in and they were like asking me these questions. So I felt in many ways for a long time like a counselor.
Oh, I bet you did.
Like a therapist for them. But, you know, hearing that even, you know, like from friends, it's like, it seems like it's so difficult to have those uncomfortable conversations with people that they go to the extremes. I mean, it ends in, you know, divorce or separation or things like that because they're just unwilling to have those conversations. And that's I think, more sad than anything else.
You're right, Russ.
You can't do it.
You can't. And I feel like as the marriage therapist, this is the part that breaks my heart is that, again, it's normal for people not to have those tools because I had this other therapist on my podcast at one point. We're talking about the concept of betrayal trauma. And we were saying how when people come to us and there's been infidelity or pornography or that sort of thing that's been exposed, that we know that if the couple really does work hard, that they're going to gain these new communication skills that they never would have had. And it is the most difficult thing to talk about where you get to say down the road, you get to say, man, had this thing not happened, this you know, pornography addiction come to light or infidelity or emotional affairs or whatever, that then they never would have gone to therapy and they never would have gotten the tools to help them communicate. So I always say, I really wish people didn't have to get to that point. So if somebody's listening to this podcast now, then it's if they're starting to feel like, okay, yeah, I don't really like the person I am who turns to porn. Doesn't make me feel good. Or if I don't like the fact that maybe in our couple's relationship that my spouse is saying, okay, let's bring the porn in, you know, it's okay to say, man, I'm going to assume these good intentions and not going to tell them they're wrong. But I want to be able to say, I wonder what it would look like if we were able to communicate better. Or I think it mm-hmm. might be important for us to at least go look for some new tools and to have their spouse not then feel like this is a personal attack, you know, like they're being criticized. Right. And so then they can start to get those tools.
You know, Tony, I mean, I feel like, and this is why, you know, you'd said towards the end of the first segment, oh, well, we kind of went on a tangent, but I do feel like we've kind of come full circle here because in many ways, as a parent, if you're giving your kids, you're displaying these tools and you're giving them these tools growing up, then it's going to be easier for them later in life to pull those tools out of that tool belt and use them.
It really is. I mean, it is. And I know we're running so short on time, but I feel like that, you know, I'm so grateful for the direction of this conversation, because as a person that works in this industry, I really feel like this stuff is the reason why we need to communicate better with our spouse, or why we need to be kind of in a better place individually, why we need to make sure that we are aware of what our own individual values are. Are we going after things in our lives that really matter to us? Do we have jobs that we really like? You know, are we in a place that with our physical health that we thought we would be? And if not, we need to start saying, okay, I'm only going around this life one time. So I really need to start taking ownership or accountability of these things.
Right.
So it's okay for me to feel uncomfortable while I seek out help to be able to communicate with my spouse better, or to be able to parent my teenager or my kids better, or to have the job that actually might be better for me, or whatever that looks like, because those really are the keys to, you know, to lessen someone turning to pornography as a coping mechanism. I mean, it really is.
Yeah. Tony, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, I could do it anytime, Russ. I feel like we could go another hour, you know?
I know, exactly. I feel like we could continue this talk, and perhaps we will on a future episode.
Anytime. Or you got to come on mine, too. We should talk about, yeah, I think we can continue that. Home and Away.
Man. I love it. So if you want to hear Tony's podcast, we'll put a link to that in the podcast description. The Virtual Couch?
Yes, that'd be great. Come listen.
Awesome.
I got
to, and then we've got TonyOverbay.com as well. And you've got The Path Back, and you can get access to that course on your website, right?
Yeah, and The Path Back has been it's Path Back Recovery. You can get through TonyOverbay.com or PathBackRecovery.com, but it is a strength-based, you know, become the person you always want to be, hold the shame, kind of a model of turning away from pornography as a coping mechanism. And I talk about all these things in that program, and we have some group calls, and it's a real strength-based model, which I think is just something that so needs to be there, because there's so much shame around it. And, you know, shame leads somebody to feeling like a horrible person, and you're just a human being trying to figure things out. So that's one of the first things I think is to get people to stop beating themselves up about this.
Tony, thank you so much for joining me and helping us learn more about sex and pornography addiction.
Russ, what a pleasure. I can't wait to do it again.
I can't wait to have you back, Tony. It was awesome. Hey, there is more Tony available in the podcast description, or you could just head over to TonyOverbay.com and check out his podcast, his courses, his books, his blog, all of that available there in the podcast description. Hey, thank you for listening, and thank you for subscribing to Learning More. We encourage you, and thank you for rating the podcasts and sharing it with friends. As with any podcast that gives medical or legal opinion, the information is not meant to substitute professional advice. We encourage you to consult a professional to discuss your exact needs. I invite you also to check out our daily podcast that I host called This Is Today, where you can learn the story of each day, including national events, daily history, and some fun stories. This Is Today is available wherever you get your podcasts. There's a link in the description to that as well. All right, next week, we have a new episode of Learning More coming out. It's a part of a two-part series on addiction. Next week, we will be talking about food addiction. Yes, please do join us next week for that topic. And if you have something that you would like to learn more about, let us know. Just head over to our website at learningmorepodcast.com. Again, thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. I'm Russ, and I look forward to learning more with you next time.